programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, encouraging participation in Dance for People with Parkinson's on Friday, April 6th at 10 a.m. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com or by calling 217-333-6280.
A large area of high pressure over the Great Lakes continues to supply us with cool and dry air. Somewhat warmer air will move into the region tomorrow ahead of a cold front approaching the Mississippi River Valley. This front will bring us a chance of showers tomorrow night. Highs this afternoon will reach the mid-50s to mid-60s across the Midwest. Low temperatures tonight will range from around freezing in northeastern Indiana to the low 40s in central Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, sunny, the high 62. The wind from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, clear with patchy frost after midnight, the low 38. The wind from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny, the high 68. The wind out of the south from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a chance of evening showers. We'll see a low in the mid-40s. The wind from the west at 5 to 10. Sunday, sunny with a high in the mid-60s. The wind will be from the northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Sunday night, mostly clear with a low in the low 40s. Monday and Monday night, partly cloudy with a high Monday around 60 and a low Monday night in the upper 30s. And the outlook Tuesday through Wednesday, partly cloudy with highs in the mid-50s and lows in the mid-30s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana, for the most part, were in the 50s, and there was quite a bit of sunshine. At Rockford, it was 52 degrees. At Chicago's O'Hare Airport, 49. In Bloomington, 53. In Mattoon, 52. In Carbondale, 54. South Bend checked in with 51. It was 53 at Lafayette. In Indianapolis, 52. Terre Haute, 56. Willard Airport reported 55 degrees at the top of the hour. The sky sunny. The dew point 29. The relative humidity 36%. The wind out of the northeast at 13. The barometric pressure 30.24 and falling. And at 1240, 54 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine from Illinois Public Media. I'm Celeste Quinn. For over 75 years, the board game Monopoly has been a cultural phenomenon, but it's also become the source of U.S. and international competition between some of the game's best players. A 2010 documentary screening in Champaign tomorrow provides a glimpse into the game's history and the strategies used by experts. Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert spoke with tournament participant and Indiana resident John Meyer about Under the Boardwalk, the Monopoly story.
The Monopoly game was not invented. It was developed from several other games, particularly by Quaker teachers, if I remember right, that were trying to teach against capitalism. I think one of them was called Finance, and I think there was another one called the Landlord's Game. The story is that Charles Darrow and his wife went out to Atlantic City for a summer vacation and played the game and wanted to take it back home to Philadelphia and build their own board from it. And originally, Parker Brothers rejected it because of several fundamental errors, and he was able to get the game selling really well at a department store in Philadelphia to get Parker Brothers to change their minds, and they bought it, and kind of the rest is history on that.
What's your earliest memory of playing Monopoly?
I would say my earliest memories will date back from when I was 10 years old. It was the 50th anniversary of the Monopoly game as we now know it, and they came out with a special game board and a spin-off game as well called Advance to Boardwalk. And that year, they also had national and world championships for that game, and I wanted to be in those someday. And since I had some pretty good math skills and was able to figure out where the players would most likely end up landing, I started to get pretty good at it after a little while playing with my sisters. Unlike some games where you just roll the dice and move your mice, Monopoly has a strategy in which you need to work well with others, and you also need to make wise investments and wise trades.
Is there a point where you realize, hey, I'm pretty good at this. I could compete in some tournaments and, you know, really maybe make a name for myself in playing the game?
1999 was the first national championship I really followed, and that was in Las Vegas. And I was following that via the Monopoly website at the time. And I was thinking, well, I get to learn a little bit more about how these are done. It's time for me to really start preparing. And sure enough, 4 years later, and that was the next one, in 2003, I was selected.
Well, and where do they have the turn? Is the tournament move around?
The tournaments do move around. In 2003, preliminary rounds for the national championship were aboard a specially painted Amtrak train that went from Chicago to Washington, D.C. To Philly, and the final game was held on a casino at Atlantic City's Boardwalk. The streets on the Standard American edition of Monopoly are named after the streets and landmarks of Atlantic City.
So talk about being involved in this documentary when you first heard about it and why you think it's an effective way of showing off what, you know, the love of fans for the game.
Well, I believe I first heard that the movie by doing a Google or Yahoo search of Monopoly tournaments, and there was a link about it, someone wanting to form a movie, and I did email the director, who is Kevin Tostado, and after a while came over to my house, since he also was filming two other people in central Indiana. And in April of 2009, he filmed several of my items, as well as asked me about my strategies, how my experience in the 03 National Championship was.
Do you have any particular specific rule changes within your family or the way you play? One thing I'm thinking about is I have played with friends that put a cash payout at free parking, but my own family never did it that way.
Well, in the official rules, free parking is just a resting space. You don't collect anything. And we certainly did have our free parking pot frequently over at the Meyer household. That's probably the most common house rule that I often see is the fines going into the free parking pot.
Are there other strategies, things that you want to, I don't know if you want to reveal, things that properties you try to snatch up right away when you're playing? Or?
Well, I will provide you a few strategies here. If you acquire a more than one developable monopoly, start building on the one that's cost less to develop, and keep developing that monopoly until you hit the three house level. Your rents usually will triple somewhere around there before you start building on the next monopoly. So the three house rule on development's very important. That's when your rents really start going up on the three houses. The more players you have in the game, the more money goes into the game. I would say in a four-player game, your oranges and light purples will probably be your best bets. And in a three-player game, the games I normally played as a kid with my two sisters, the light blues were more effective since they were nicely located from go, and they were only $50 a house to develop. In other words, if you had the monopoly, and there were enough houses and hotels in the bank, you could put hotels on there for $750 total.
Did you learn any other secrets from when you were in the tournament or just from either playing or casual conversations with people that, you know, maybe were better than you at it?
Well, one of the other strategies is jail is not always bad to be in. If it's early in the game, if you're sent to jail, just pay the $50 and get out. And that's because there are still properties for sale, and you got to keep your little token moving. But once it's late in the game and all the properties have been bought, or someone has a developed monopoly against you, you want to stay in jail as long as you can. That way, it's less likely that you will be hitting that developed monopoly before other players do. And also, if you have a developed monopoly of your own, you can start building that up while you're still in jail, since you, according to the rules, you can still make trades, collect rent, and buy houses and hotels while you're still in jail.
Have you been a fan of any of the pop culture variations? I know there's probably more than 100 different kinds of Monopoly games now tied to, I don't know, Star Wars, Harry Potter, things like that.
A few of them. I do have a few at home. I am particularly fond of the Indianapolis edition of Monopoly. It came out about 15 years ago, published by USAopoly. USAopoly makes quite a few of the special editions that you'll see more at specialty stores. And Hasbro does make a few of the specialties as well. And I do have a couple of those, but I don't need 50 games that are going to play the same way.
Jeff Bosser talked with Monopoly National Championship participant and Mulberry, Indiana resident John Meyer. He's featured in the documentary Under the Boardwalk, The Monopoly Story. Meyer will introduce tomorrow's noon hour screening at the Art Theater in Champaign. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. The Downstate Innocence Project's latest victory was the exoneration of a wrongfully convicted man in Kane County. It's an example of why the organization is announcing a name change to the Illinois Innocence Project. Director Larry Golden says he'll make it official Monday at the 5th Annual Defenders of the Innocent Awards reception in Springfield. Golden talked about it with Illinois Public Radio's Amanda Vinicky.
This has come about as a result of the capacity that we've developed and the demand that's out there for us to take cases in northern Illinois. And we thought it would be really confusing to people for us to remain the Downstate Illinois Innocence Project at the same time we were working on cases up in the Chicago suburbs and occasionally even in Cook County.
All with the goal, of course, of successes such as the latest exoneree, who will be at the University of Illinois Springfield on Monday, Jonathan Moore. And he recently got out of prison about 3 weeks ago in early March after spending a dozen years in custody for a crime he did not commit. This is significant, Larry, because you say that the police were really involved. It was not solely initiated by the Innocence Project.
It is an extraordinary case. Really, evidence had come to the Aurora police indicating that John was innocent. They reopened the case. They followed up on it. They got additional evidence to corroborate his innocence. They went to him while he was in prison and told him they had this evidence. He contacted us to help him. The goal here was justice. It was not defensiveness. It was not trying to closed down because it was a closed case from 12 years ago that they didn't want to spend time on. And we were really pleased to be able to go to court on a motion by the state's attorney on March 6th that allowed John to get out of prison. He was pretty shell-shocked. All this happened within the space of 72 hours. We're really pleased that he's going to be able to be here so we can celebrate that exoneration.
This case is also important because you say that it hid some of the factors that contributed to Jonathan Moore or Jonathan Grayson going to prison in the first place was the predominant role of eyewitness testimony during the trial. And also, at the time, Mr. Moore had, in a sense, confessed to being at the crime scene, although it now appears that wasn't the case. Listeners might well say, well, are the prosecutors to be blamed or the police to be blamed when somebody who's accused of the crime basically admits to being there? And then that doesn't turn out to be true. How does that happen?
You know, particularly the issue of blame. I think if we can put that aside for a moment and just say that practices and policies have built up over a long period of time that result in police and even prosecutors reacting in certain ways to what has been done, which is actually in a process of significant change. And you're exactly right. Two of the most common factors in cases where people have been exonerated are eyewitness misidentification, which occurs actually in three-quarters of all the cases where people have been exonerated. There has been a mistaken eyewitness identification. And in Illinois in particular, but also across the country in about a third of the cases, false confessions. In this particular case, there were two eyewitnesses, one of whom put Jonathan there at the scene as the perpetrator, whose testimony was later discredited. And in fact, there is some evidence to point to a specific individual who did commit the crime. And then secondly, two statements that John made to police, which basically said, I was there, but I didn't do it. Those of us who've studied this understand that the way police questioning has occurred in the past, it would be fairly easy to get that kind of a statement. For example, let's assume that you were pulled in and it was a serious crime and police had you and they were talking to you and they said, look, just tell us you were there and you didn't pull the trigger and you'll be able to walk out. And so all we have are simple statements. They're not recorded. We don't know.